be unkind on my part if I didn't take just a moment to express my appreciation to you for the invitation to come. Words cannot express how much those of you I've known through these years mean to me. And to Janet, I appreciate the encouragement I've received from you through many years, and it is good to see you here today. Our lesson this morning that has been asked that we speak on this, and my lesson has been chosen for me, which make it easy on my part, and I appreciate you doing that, is the God who is there, or do we, you know, we've loaded the wrong one. This should be the God who is there. My fault. Anyway, I'll get into it while you do the right thing, okay? So it's the God who is there. Yeah, it may just say God. Or it may just say 2383. One night years ago, I was walking from our house to the building. We lived in Murfreesboro at the time. We lived, 13 steps from our house to the building. And I looked up and I was watching the stars. It was beautiful, beautiful. And then while I was looking at those lights, I saw some lights that were moving much quicker than you see any kind of star appear to move. You're a good man. And I was looking at these things and I wondered what's going on here, and it took me back for a moment and I realized it was a plane. We had a number of low-flying planes that were descending at that point, headed to the National Airport, 30-something miles away. And I thought, here are these lights that are moving and here are these other lights that appear stationary. And a lot of folks say those lights that we call the stars just came into existence. Maybe a great explosion, maybe a big bang of some sort. But those lights that are flying into Nashville, everybody admits, were made by a mind that was very intelligent to be able to put these things together. The Wright brothers worked for a long time on a plane, but we've come so far since the Wright brothers. But they did work on it. We all admit a plane is something that was created. It was something that didn't used to exist. And now it does. And yet, are we to assume that this thing that is not nearly as complex as the universe, this thing that flew into Nashville, is evidence of great design and intelligence, but what we see up there is just a big explosion? We don't know how it happened, but boy, it's wonderful, isn't it? Who can believe such things? And it doesn't really take a lot of study to realize, it's mostly just common sense to realize, nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever good, as they sing in the old song. And that's basically what we see here when we talk about the God who is there. When you look at Genesis 1, verse 14 and following, which I will not elaborate on because that's one of our lessons, God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night. And let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years." God is the one who's responsible for these lights being there and presenting this glorious image we have on a nightly basis when it's not cloudy. And also in Psalm 8, you see similar things that are said concerning this creative act. It's something that is affirmed from Old Testament to New and many passages in between. Psalm 8, "O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. You who set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and infants you have ordained strength. Because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you're mindful of him? And the son of man that you visit him?" This is a very short section, four verses that speak of God, how majestic God is, the earth that God made for us, that he is the creator who put these things into existence. It speaks of his splendor in the heavens, the work of his hands, his fingers. And it's very well known that as in Exodus 8, verse 19, when Pharaoh finally has his eyes open, the magicians and others say, look, you better change your course or view your course here, because this is nothing but the finger of God. The finger of God was that creative power that could cause things to happen. In the case of Egypt, they didn't want to happen, but in the case of creation, that we definitely do want to happen, and we're glad that it did. And that he mentions here the finger of God, great symbol of power, and also man, who benefits from this creation that God made. So it speaks of God, his majesty. It speaks of the earth that he made, that he is the creator. It speaks of his splendor that he has provided, the fingers that he used to do it, and his concern for man. What is man that you're mindful of him? You have concern for man. This is a marvelous passage. And then in Daniel 2, verse 28, Daniel explains that he's not the power behind his prophecies, but he does say there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Now, the ancient world, they had a view that the earth was composed of several things that just came into place. They don't really explain how they came into place, but you can see it was all based on some elephants who were supporting the earth, and then people were living on the earth. That was a very simple view that they had of how we got here. And then they said, well, where are the elephants? What do they stand on? Well, somebody says, well, they stand on this gigantic tortoise. And this tortoise allows them to have some stability. Well, what does a tortoise stand on? Well, he stands on water. He stands on water. And the elephants are on him and the earth on that. And it makes you wonder, how could anybody laugh at the Bible in view of the views that men have had? But in modern evolution, we've become more sophisticated in our explanation. We say, here's man. Where did man come from? Well, he came from the apes. Even Darwin, in his Origin of Species, says so. Where did the monkey come from? He came from a frog, an amphibious animal. Well, where did he come from? From a single-cell amoeba. And then, where did he come from? Dirt and rocks. All that we have here, all the life that we see here, comes from dirt and rocks. I have a little problem with that. I have a little problem understanding the connection between dirt and rocks and people. I walk on dirt and I throw rocks. Am I disrupting some future person that's going to be made out of that? I really don't think so. And so we raise the question, the greatness of the universe, the complexity of the human body itself, and we say that it just came about because one thing changed into another. There are no observers for this. You notice that there's nobody who can tell us that this is the way it took place. We're told that it took place over multiplied millions of years. We don't see it repeated, which is part of the scientific method. And therefore, it must be a matter of faith. But wait a minute, I thought faith was something that Christians have, and it just means they think it and want it to be so, but it's not really true, right? Well, I think the shoe's on the other foot here. And so the problem is very simple. Some people claim that the earth, life, and humans all came from nothing. Now let that sink in for a moment. Everything we see came from nothing. There was nothing, and then presto, all that we see has come into being. Someone put it this way, this is Stinger, who said, it is not sufficient merely to say you can't get something from nothing. He's affirming you can. While everyday experience and common sense seem to support this principle, if there's anything that we've learned from 20th century physics, it is this. Common sense is often wrong, and our normal experiences are but a tiny fraction of reality, which means if that's true, we can't know anything. We just don't know anything. People can say, well, we know here's how the earth came about, but as he points out in the end, they can't know that at all. They don't know anything at all if these principles are what we adhere to. Did the earth, the stars, and humans come from nothing? Where did matter come from in the first place, to allow the existence of these things? Where was the matter? Who made the matter? Or did it just always exist? Does the scientific method observe something coming from nothing? You put nothing on the table, you hope it turns into food. Well, good luck with that. A teenager would go crazy thinking that's how you're going to get food for him. The scientific method says you start by observing and you ask a question. You hypothesize, you predict, you test, you analyze, you examine the results. But you can't do that with the things that are beyond the pale of man's ability to perceive. And then how do skeptics react to the Lord's miracles? Well, it's very interesting. They're contrary to our normal experience. That may ring a bell for you. But experience is a tiny fraction of reality, isn't it? That's what we were told a moment ago. And so you have something like this. I don't believe in the Lord's miracles because they're contrary to our experience. Well, how then did we get here? Well, normal experiences are a fraction of reality. They may produce matter from nothing. You can use anything you want as long as it's for what you want. But you can't use it if it has anything to do with Scripture. So, I don't believe in miracles, someone says, but I do believe that matter can come from nothing. Okay. Consistency is indeed a rare virtue. Now, how do you explain this house? I could tell you I have a house like this in each of the 50 states. How did they get here? Well, it's not a problem. You just go and you wish it, and all of a sudden there it is. No financing, no payments. You ought to try it. Let me know how it turns out. This house, actually, I don't have a clue who lives in this house. But I wonder, how can you explain it? Is it an illusion? Some people explain things by an illusion. You know, in a burning desert, you can see mirages out there, and you think, oh, that's water, and you run over to it, and it's not water at all. I was in the hospital several years ago, and they persuaded me if I would use a morphine pump, I'd get out quicker. So I started pumping that thing. And I started seeing a man in polka dot waders trying to baptize somebody. I remember seeing someone do taekwondo with a pump for my medicine. I saw wonderful things. I talked to other people, say, you see those bugs over there? They need to clean this place up. There's no bug anywhere inside. You can see wonderful things if you put the right stuff in your system. So maybe the universe is just an illusion. Maybe it's not really here. Maybe we're not really here. I remember watching Mortimer Adler on Firing Line 30 years ago. He was a man who came to fully believe in God and in Christ when he was about 98. He was a philosopher who did the great book series. But there was a mathematician on there examining him on this particular occasion on Firing Line. The man said, well, you know, I can't even prove to you I'm here. In fact, I don't even know that I exist. And Mortimer Adler later said, I should have thrown a book at him and just see what he did, because I think he would have thought he existed when the book came flying at him. But the fact of it is, if this is true, then we don't even know if we're real. And that's what some want us to say. And so nothing really matters. And yet, when something comes along that does matter, they want it to be that we are real. Then the second explanation, maybe it's eternal. It's just self-existent, and it's always existed. Maybe this house always existed. Now, does that explain it? What evidence would we have for it being self-existent? And furthermore, since this house is wearing out, and I'm sorry to tell you, if you have a house, it's wearing out. It's older now than it's ever been, and it's going to get older and older. And finally, it won't be there. Given enough time, that's going to be the case. So, how did it get here? We have something called entropy that takes place. I feel it every day. We're running down. There's only so much to start with, and then you start losing that as you chew stuff, and then you're gone. Well, look at this house. Could it be eternal? Wouldn't it have already been used up eons ago? Well, certainly it would. So an illusion is not a very good explanation. To say it's eternal is not a very good explanation. That brings up the third one. Maybe it created itself. That takes an imagination. Can you imagine it in your mind, something creating itself? It would have to be and not be at the same time. And that's against the law of non-contradiction. That won't work. You cannot have something creating itself. if it creates itself, it already existed and therefore was already created before it had anything to create. So it doesn't explain how it originally got there. And so what we see here is out of nothing, nothing comes. If nothing existed, nothing would exist now. If this house ever did not exist, there's no way it could ever create itself. And then third, or fourth rather, the only other possibility I know of is an intelligent designer. And that's exactly what you see the New Testament itself affirming, as well as the Old Testament. Hebrews 3, in speaking of certain things pertaining to the children of Israel and making some comparisons here, mentions in verse 3, this one, speaking of Christ, has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. He who built all things is God. That word built is the same word as in chapter 11, verse 7, where it speaks of Noah building the ark. In fact, it's a favorite word for the construction of ships. So every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. Then Hebrews 11, verse 3, by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. That expression, the worlds, all the things we see in existence about us, the worlds were framed, they were created, they were prepared by the word of God. God simply spoke. They call that divine fiat. He says, let there be. And there was. So when you look at these things that are here, we know that God spoke the word and they're here. Well, somebody says, well, that's impossible. Well, what's impossible is for it to be here and nothing cause it. There had to be an uncaused first cause. And that uncaused first cause is all wise and can speak words and can do wonderful things. And there's much evidence of that fact. Now, how do we explain the stars then? If we have to use these ways of reasoning to look at the house we've just seen. Now, let's apply the same reasoning to the stars. How do we explain the stars? Are they an illusion? Maybe we don't really see stars at all. It's just a mirage. Nobody really believes that. Is it that they are eternal? If so, how could they always exist? And even if they did, how would that explain life on Earth? I don't know of any stars that are creating life. Do you? It'd have to be pretty hot life, wouldn't it? And then, could they have created themselves? What star has created itself? I don't know. And then what intelligent designer was behind it? That's the explanation. And that's the one the Bible itself gives us. Now, the proof for these things. We've looked at the problem. Look at the proof for these things. God's design is something that is spoken of repeatedly in Scripture. Let me get you to turn to Job chapter 38. Job 38 is in a section of Job that is like a breath of fresh air. The first couple of chapters are God's dealing with the charges of Satan. In chapter 3, Job starts to speak, and he regrets the day he was even born. And then in chapter 4, Eliphaz. And Eliphaz is so far off the mark, he's going to be severely accused by the Lord himself as being so far worthy of condemnation for what he's claimed of God. But in chapter 38, God speaks. God is speaking. This is pure revelation straight from God to Job. And it says, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Job has been saying, I wish I could have an audience with God. I wish I could meet him in court. I wish I could get him to answer for me. Why did you do these things to me? Why have you punished me like this? What have I done to deserve this? Oh, if I could have my day in court, I would stand up and speak and he would not be able to answer me. And now Job gets his day in court and he says, what in the world was I thinking? He answers him out of the whirlwind. And he says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now, prepare yourself. Prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. And then he starts asking Job about some of the wonderful things he's created. In verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. You've dared question God, so you must know as much as God. In fact, more if you can question him. Who determined its measurements? Or who stretched the line upon it? Builders always are stretching their line to make sure this lumber is the same length as that over there. To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, probably a reference to angels, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut in the sea with doors? When it burst forth and issued from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come, but no farther, and here your proud waves must stop. When you look at this in verses 1 to 4, you see the earth. Marvelous, marvelous creation. And he says, where were you when I laid the foundation of this? In verse 16, he goes on to say, have you entered the springs of the sea? Give us a report about this. This is before the days of submarines. Closest one got to a submarine in those days was Jonah and the great fish. And it wasn't a ride he enjoyed. But God knew everything in the sea, even in the Marianas Fault, where no one has seen things for so many years. And all these beautiful creatures there, and God knew it all along. Why would he put such beauty in a place where a man couldn't see it? I don't know. But that's what God did. He says, or have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? So he's talking here about the sea. And then in verses 19 to 21, he talks about light itself, something that we really can't totally define properly. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place, that you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths to its home? Do you know it because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? What are your qualifications, Job, to criticize me and to tell me about these things that exist? And then one more, the stars. And 31, can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season, or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Just as God would use artistic, creative ability to make the beautiful creatures of the bottom of the sea, he would make beautiful constellations in the sky with the stars he made. He didn't just sling them up there. He made beautiful things out of them and recognizes that men can see these patterns in them. By this time, I'm sure Job is thinking, why did I have to open my big mouth? It would be better to be quiet and just listen. But for the rest of this, until God prompts him, he does keep his mouth closed. Now, something either is or it is not. That's just a basic proposition. Either there is an earth and a sea and light and stars and man and creatures and so on, or we don't exist and we just are a figment of our own imaginations, which gets into another problem there. Something either exists or it does not. Now, which one is the case? Well, of course, they had to have come about. So there's a creation. Then number two, what is either created or it's eternal. So did it get here because it is simply thought into being? Or did someone say it's always been here? No, it would have been created. And we know this for several reasons. You take a candle. You come to my house and you look at the table. There's a candle about this big and it's burning. And you say, how long has that candle been burning? I said, for all eternity. Now, do you see something wrong with this? Well, the first thing wrong is I have a very serious mental issue. But then the second thing is, if it had always been burning, what would it look like now? It would have burned up, wouldn't it? It cannot be eternal. I can affirm it, but that doesn't prove it. And then suppose you have a barrel of water, maybe a 50-gallon drum. Put a little tiny little spigot in it, and you let one drop every hour. And you look at that, and you see this little puddle down there, and you say, how long has water been dripping out of that barrel? And I said, for all past eternity. What would you know is the case? It has nothing else being poured into it. It's a closed system. And yet, what's in it is coming out. Well, you would know that couldn't be eternal, wouldn't you? And then when you look at the sun, how long has the sun been there? Oh, for all ages past, it's eternal. What would you know? It would have burned up by now. It has so much fuel, and the fuel would be gone, and we wouldn't exist because we couldn't live without it. So, something either is or it isn't. Well, I take the view we really do exist. It either was created or it's eternal. I believe it has to have been created. Then the third, this creator is either intelligent or unintelligent. If it was a matter of a single cell organism rubbing some way and then getting an arm and rubbing the other way and getting another arm and rubbing two different ways and getting legs and growing like this and just happening to find another one just like it at the time it can reproduce with all of its complexity of systems, the irreducible complexity of systems, we would say, well, that looks to me as if that's the way we ought to go. Nobody argues that way. They want to. The house could not have always existed. Neither could the universe, which is infinitely more complex than that house. You have electrical systems and other things, water systems in that house, plumbing. Nothing can compare to the complexity of the universe in which we live. The anthropic principle says to us that there are certain things that happen that are made just right for man's existence on earth. I want to run through these very quickly. The anthropic principle can be illustrated in Job 38, verse 34. Can you lift your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? And what that is saying is that we have rain that comes. If we didn't have rain, we couldn't exist in this world. That's an anthropic principle that God made it so that it would rain. In verse 39, can you hunt the prey for the lion? There is the law of the jungle, but there's also this system that God has created so that plants are the basic life of everything, and we all eat those or eat those who eat those. And they had to come about. And so you see in verse 39, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions? The lion attacks its prey. First thing it attacks is the stomach area where the food, the vegetables are in there rotting. And it eats those. We all go back to the veggies at one point or another. The oxygen level, Earth's atmosphere is 21% oxygen. 25%, you would have fires that would erupt spontaneously. That'd be a thrill one night. You're lying there and all of a sudden your house just starts erupting. If it were 15%, we would suffocate. We couldn't live. The atmospheric transparency, if it were less transparent, there would not be enough solar radiation to reach the Earth's surface. If it were more, we would be bombarded with too much solar radiation. The moon and the Earth and the gravitational interaction, if it were greater, the tidal effects on the oceans, the atmosphere and the rotational period would be too severe. There would be no life on Earth. If it were less, the orbital changes would cause climactic instabilities. Either one would prevent life on Earth. If you look at it from the standpoint of the carbon dioxide level, if CO2 were higher, we would be in a runaway greenhouse effect. We would burn up, basically. If it were lower, the plants could not maintain efficient photosynthesis, and we'd suffocate. Gravity, if the gravitational force were altered by 0.000, and I'll let you do the rest of those, 0.1%, the sun would not exist, thus neither would we. We acknowledge intelligent design every day. If you look, for example, at the plane that I saw, look at a plane one night. Flying over with its lights. Beautiful sight. It's beautiful even in the daytime. No one believes the plane is the result of a tornado that went through a metal factory. We don't believe that. It's too complex for it to be that way. And by the way, explosions, as in big bangs, cause disorder. Things don't ever produce wonderful stuff by that. You can set off a firecracker among leaves. It doesn't build you a log cabin. And on we can go. That's no sillier than what some people say about the way we got here. You look at a statue. I remember going to Peoria, Illinois. And in their park is a statue of Robert Ingersoll, the famous agnostic. He was from there. And he used to go around and give these speeches all over the country after the Civil War. He was a colonel in the Civil War. And he'd give these speeches. And he'd say, "Now look, I don't know that there's a God." He's an agnostic. I don't know that there's a God, but we can put it to the test. "I'm going to stand here and hold my watch, and I'm going to let 5 minutes pass. If there is a God, let him strike me dead. And so at my expense, you can know that he does exist. If he doesn't strike me dead, then we know there's no God. Or else, if he is, he's not on duty." Isn't it interesting that when his brother died some years later, he preached the funeral? Now, how would an agnostic preach a funeral? They had agreed, he and his brother, whoever died first, the other preached the funeral. He's preaching his brother's funeral. What's he going to say? He broke down several times during his attempts to preach the funeral. And then he said, "Oh God, if there be a God." What? He said, "We would like to have the hope that maybe there is something beyond." I thought this was the man who wasn't struck dead, and therefore there shouldn't be a God. Isn't it amazing how things change when you or a loved one faces death? If atheism or agnosticism is not good enough to die for, I doubt it's good enough to live for. And then you have the statue that is of a man. You have the real man himself, which is more complex. You say the statue was made and the man just happened. That doesn't make sense. And then you look at a camera. It's long been the interest of mine concerning the complexity of the eye and the ear. And as you look at the eye, Proverbs 20, verse 12 says, "The hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both." Darwin was absolutely scared of the eye. It's something that buffaloed him. It's something that puzzled him. It's something that made him doubt himself. He made this comment in The Origin of Species. It's in page 227 in my book. "To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus," just like a camera would, only much better, "to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration." So to suppose that it could have been formed by natural selection, which is what he preached, seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. And yet he goes on to say that minute variations could produce such complexities. Later in 1860, in a letter to Asa Gray, a professor of natural history in Harvard, he said, "About the weak points, I agree." Several were questioning many of the things he was saying. "About the weak points, I agree. The eye, to this day, gives me a cold shudder. But when I think of the fine known gradations, my reason tells me I ought to conquer the cold shudder. So when I see some of the things that I've learned, it makes me conclude it must have come about by natural selection." The cochlear implant in the ear. Remember, the hearing ear and the seeing eye of the Lord has made them both. They're stellar accomplishments. And when a person loses his hearing, there's a cochlear device that they use these days that is pretty amazing. And yet, it doesn't let them hear the distinctions in sound that they used to. It doesn't let them hear, for example, music as they used to hear it and know that it exists. It's the best we can do for now, and yet it's not perfect. And yet, who would look either at a camera or a cochlear implant and say, "They just happened. The wind blew one day and it knocked this piece of tin into this piece of plastic and it made a camera. Or it made an ear you can put in there, and if your ear goes bad, you can replace your ear." Who would say such a thing? Nobody. And yet this universe is far more complex than the camera or the cochlear implant. The robotic hand has also been a fascination to me. I remember as a boy seeing this man who I met him at funerals two or three times when I was a boy. He had a prosthetic arm, and it was just merely as a mannequin hand. He couldn't manipulate the fingers. He couldn't move the arm. He could take it on and off, of course. But that's all he could do. They continued to work on the hand over a period of time, and they managed to come up with some pretty good stuff. And in February of 2014, a Dutch man lost his left hand in a fireworks accident 9 years before. Now he can feel different kinds of pressure on three fingers of his prosthetic robotic hand. It's a new device that delivers feedback directly to the remaining nerves in the man's arm. The work was carried out by researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne, Switzerland. And another project at Case Western Reserve University, they're testing a different type of implant that delivers various kinds of sensations and has been attached to an Ohio man's arm for 19 months. This implant is still reliably delivering sensations such as touching ball bearings, sandpaper, or cotton balls on 20 spots on his hand and fingers. Now, it's not nearly as good as the hand we have. So let's ask this question. This man who has this artificial hand can touch a few things, not nearly as many as you can in your real hand. Do we think that happened by accident? Does anybody in the world think that hand happened by accident? I've never heard anybody say yes. Well, then this hand that we have that can do infinitely more. By the way, their hardest thing is the thumb. The thumb is one of the most amazing devices that has ever been created. I won't go into that. It's a fascination of mine. But his thumb can't do nearly the things that our thumb can do. Are we to say this happened by accident? And his was a result of intelligent design? Who can believe this stuff? It's really simple. And I think that's what disappoints people, because it is so simple. And then we ask the question concerning the computer. Now, I like computers when they act the way they're supposed to. I'm not nearly as good as Jeremiah is one of them, obviously. I could say maybe someday, but it's never going to happen. But it can do marvelous things. I don't have the memory capacity for certain things that a programmed computer has. But notice the word programmed. It didn't just happen. It was put in there. It was made to be able to do what it does. It was programmed. Are we to say that our brain, which is infinitely more complex than a computer, our brain just happened? What if our brain froze like a Microsoft computer did? Wouldn't that be a thrill? What if we had to reboot our brain like you have to reboot a computer? That could be trouble in traffic. What if we had to replace our brain every 3 or 4 or 5 years like you do a computer? What we have up here on every level is so far superior to these little things, as great as they are, that there's no comparison. And yet, that was made by intelligence and this just happened? Who can believe that? And then the city water system. When you think about the food stores, the people walking around, the various jobs, the various buildings, the water system itself. But these things are very complex systems. Have you noticed the complexity of a human cell lately? In Darwin's day, he thought a cell was just a little bubble, basically. No complexity at all. And now they talk about cellular biology and all these things that show the great complexity of these things. It's like a miniature city. And we say that this just happened. And then the human body's system. We talk about the circulatory system. Men spend their entire lives studying that one system, and they become that kind of physician to be able to deal with those. And they will admit they don't know everything about that system. They study just as frequently the nervous system, the respiratory system, the reproductive system, the skeletal system. Scientists study it for a lifetime without mastering a single one of these systems. They are that complex. They're that complicated. The first man and woman could not live with a circulatory system alone. They had to have all these systems at once. If one of these systems were missing, how would they live? How would they take care of themselves? And notice, it also had to be two persons at one time with both of these systems working. It couldn't just be one little single cell amoeba that became this. It had to be two at the same time, at the same place, with the same structure. So if they had no circulatory system, no nervous system, no reproductive system, those are so complex a man can spend a lifetime studying them and never master them. How do we think these things could have just happened in two persons at one time? Creation reveals a divine creator. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. When you break this down, Paul affirms the creation of the world, as do all the biblical writers who speak on it. It speaks of his invisible attributes, and yet we know some things about God merely by looking at the things he's made. If someone shows me a computer, I don't have to know who did it. I can say there's somebody with intelligence. I can know certain things about that man. He doesn't have a two-year-old mind doing this. I know certain things about him. These are understood by the things that are made. The things that are made, the things that God made, let us reason back to him as the creator. Even his eternal, he always was, he's the uncaused first cause who is himself eternal. The eternal power and Godhead. So the result of all this, he says, is they are without excuse. The New Testament itself appeals to the proof of God by the design in his creation. Just as does Psalm 8, just as does Psalm 19, so many other passages. Now, you look at the word creation, you look at his invisible attributes are clearly seen, and you look at the word eternal, and you say, something's going on here that is beyond what any man could have done. No man was around to do it. Jesus, in John 1:3, he's the one who created all things. No one has been created. No thing has been created that he hasn't created. He was God's agent in the creation. He endorsed the Old Testament creation. He, the Son of God, who rose from the dead, has put his stamp of approval, his agreement on the Old Testament creation as being historical and authoritative. And he would say in Mark 10, verse 6, but from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. I said a moment ago, nobody was there to be an eyewitness. There was one eyewitness, and that's Christ, who himself was taking part in that creation. He said it happened just as the old law says. Thank you very much for your kindness.